This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hello and welcome again to Moments That Rock. I'm your host, Tony Michael. This, we're part of the Pantheon group of podcasts, and every week we pump out Moments That Rocked, various music industry insiders and artists' careers. As usual, we leave the rest to the guest.
Hi, Tony.
Hi, Shaz.
Good to see you again after all these years.
I know. Tell us about yourself.
I'm a busy boy. I'm the one of these people who can't stop volunteering for things. I'm the secretary of Manchester United Disabled Supporters Association, which has been a lifelong love. And I've been doing that for about the last 12 years, something like that. I've been involved with MUDSA before that for 25 years, organising annual dinners and social events. And we turned it into a really big organisation now. And you've got members all over the world. And I'm also the chair of the Northwest Wheelchair User Group. And for these and other things, the King very kindly granted me the MBE last year, which I went down to Windsor and got last November. So I hope you're bowing there, Tony.
Congratulations. So, Chaz, every time I see Chaz Banks, though, it's kind of like my bank is Chase. So yeah. It kind of reminds me of you, Chase Bank.
Yeah, if you Google me, it comes up a lot, Chase Bank. So, yeah, that all keeps me busy, busier than ever. Still seeing the guys, still see the fan club. Had lunch with Charles from the Pixies when they were here in Manchester. They were playing the Albert Hall. There were three nights now. They've got this really nice scenario going where they do three nights in venues and they don't go in hotels anymore. They get apartments and they travel with the partners, and it's just like so organized, you know, and so different. And they've got this, it's like a little cottage industry now, Tony, because they're not really with a big label. They put their own records out. Because you can contact your fan base, the internet's changed everything. And I was with last night I was at the Lowry in Salford, and I was with this guy, Alan, plays drums in a tribute band called Rumours of Fleetwood Mac. And he's a big mate of Mick Fleetwood, and he's actually got Mick Fleetwood comes on a video and introduces them. And these guys are absolutely stunning. I couldn't believe it. I was blown away. But they've got two trucks and two buses outside. They're playing venues in the States, 5,000, 6,000 capacity venues, and they're making a lot of money. And it's like finding people who've managed to get a little niche now. Teenage Fan Club are the same, you know, thanks to Raymond. You know, Raymond's really well organised, and he took the management back from us when, back in the day, because we carried on managing them after I went into the wheelchair. And I went to New York in the wheelchair, and I was still learning about being in a wheelchair and all that, to negotiate, well, not negotiate, a record deal, because we were with Creation, as you know, mm-hmm. and Alan McGee sold it to Sony. And so that meant we were with Columbia in the UK. The new guy, what's his name? What was his name? MacDonald, Brett MacDonald or Brad MacDonald, I can't remember. And he was a huge fan, Scottish guy, massive fan. And he arranged for us, he wanted us to go. We were going to go out to America and do a tour anyway. And we'd got out of our deal with Geffen. And because when Teenage Fan Club were leaders, you know, they signed separate deals. They signed a deal with Geffen for the US They signed a deal with Creation for the rest of Europe, which meant you got two record companies sort of vying against each other, which is always a good thing if they're fighting each other, they're not fighting you, you know.
Absolutely.
You can sort of squeeze in the gaps in the middle. And so Creation paid for me to go over to, sorry about all the beeps, by the way, there's a big United thing going on today. Yeah, we had the fans forum last week, so the minutes are coming out today, so there'll be pinging going on all over the place, and I don't know how to turn it off. I'm not that technically minded, you know. So, yeah, I went over to New York, and McGee paid for it and all that, and met the guy who used to run Columbia at the time. Now, I'm talking 97. You might remember him, Tony. He was an Italian-Jewish New Yorker.
Walter Yetnikoff?
No, it was the one after him. But I'm there and I've got the new Teenage Fan Club album, you know. And I'm like, I must admit, I was a bit, you go into the corner office and you know how it works in America. You've got this huge corner office because he's the CEO, he's the big boss. And he's got a guitar signed by Bruce Springsteen there and he's got all this stuff on the wall. A bit like behind you there with all your records. I've got mine on the lobby going upstairs. Getting back to New York and this corner office. So I'm there to sort of play a couple of Teenage Fan Club tracks and impress this guy and get Columbia on side. Blair McDonald, that was his name, Blair.
Oh, right.
And Blair's really keen on me going there and doing this and all that. Because in America, you have to go there and work the company, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And he just absolutely... I mean, if I wasn't in the wheelchair, I'd say he kicked the legs out from under me. He said, I've got a tape. Just have a listen to this. Tell me what you think. And he played me this tape. And what it was a Bob Dylan song that I hadn't heard at that time. And he'd got a guy, a professional musician, to demo it. Just a voice and a piano. And it was a song called To Make You Feel My Love.
Hmm.
To make you feel my, I go walking down the avenue, da 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 da. You know the song, yeah?
Yeah.
Sure, you don't listen to it that often. I sat there and I looked at Cheryl and I thought, we're fucked. What can you do? It's like, he said, what do you think? I said, that is a number one hit. That is a massive worldwide number one hit. Unbelievable. What are you going to do with it? He said, well, I got it for Billy Joel. You know, I got him to do it, but Billy didn't want to do it. And then he did do it, and I persuaded him to. But then, you know what he's like. He did the arrangement and all that. In the meantime, Garth Brooks jumped in and had a massive hit with it. And then Adele had a massive hit with it. And then a whole series of people appeared on Britain's Got Talent and had hits with it and whatever, and on it went. But I heard it before any of those people had heard it.
Yeah.
But it just, like, made me feel about an inch tall. You know, it was just like, Here's the game the big boys are playing, you know what I mean? Just go out there son, and get all you like. But he's a nice chap, you know, but it was like, this is the game you're playing in now in America. It's like, you suddenly became very aware of that enormity of breaking America, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Perception is everything here, you know, they embrace success, whereas, you know, especially coming from the north of England where, you know, there's a certain amount of cynicism. I always say to people, you know, you get a buzz with a band in England and you walk out to, like, maybe 400 or 500 people after the front cover of the NME back in the day, and people are there, like, with their arms crossed, like, come on, impress me, you know. In America, you come out and everybody raises their hands and goes berserk before you play a note.
Yeah, they go out to have a good time. It's just it's the entertainment industry, you know, and I always knew at that point, from my experiences of working in America and touring in America, that eventually they would take over. And of course, that's exactly what they have done. You know, they've Taylor Swifted the life, you know, within an inch of its life. We've got this new arena opening in Manchester now. And everything's changed, you know, from back in my day when you were managing and you'd go out and try and get a publishing deal and a record deal, and you'd have an agent and you'd do all that. Well, now they do these global deals, and my mate, his son, one of his sons, was talking to record companies, and I said, don't do it, don't bother. I wouldn't bother if I was you. I'd put your own music out, because they're going to want your publishing, they're going to want your management, they're going to want your
merchandise,
they're going to want your firstborn. You know what I mean? It's like the whole thing will come after you. And what they'll do, if you've already got a manager, is they'll go to that group and they'll whisper in the ear. And I saw Creation do this with a young guy from Manchester who had a band. But, you know, they went and told the artist, these guys are being really difficult and all that. You know, they're going to ruin your career. Why don't you go with this guy in London here? You know, in other words, our mate. So that's a common ploy. But it's happened in, like, all my mates who I used to know in the sound industry, they Wigwam's gone. They're owned by a company called Solar Tech, who are owned by a company in Canada, who now own all the major PA companies in the UK. They own the venues, they own the merchandise, they own the PA systems, they own everything, you know. It's just become this giant
monopolies, though, isn't it? It's like the thing that's going on with Live Nation now. It's kind of like governing the price of the tickets and, you know, the whole Taylor Swift thing again, where people were desperate to get tickets. Sorry?
The dynamic pricing thing.
It's like the big players come in and they kind of want to control everything. And I think the music industry, I mean, obviously we both go back a long time, but there's no such thing as artist development now. And that's what I loved, you know, working with bands from day one and watching them grow. Whereas nowadays, like, you know, you've got to be your own artist development. You've got to get on social media. They won't even listen to you unless you've got 500,000 followers.
I mean, I think there was always an element of that because, I mean, we have radio shows. I watched one the other day, One Hit Wonders at the BBC. Mm. That's always happened. But there was never, it was never as bad as it is now in terms of career development. But the other thing that I see is I see a lot more middle-class kids like Coldplay and Radiohead and stuff like that, who've got the parents behind them and they've got money and they are smart. They're well-educated. A lot of them have been to private schools, you know, like the Genesis of this world and people like Pink Floyd, you know, went to private schools. And they're really smart and they're business savvy and they know what to do. They know how to pursue the career and they have a certain amount of talent. And I've been to see a lot of these bands and what I found, I mean, for example, I went to see Snow Patrol last year and they did a 90-minute show and I reckon there was four really good songs in that.
Mm.
Maybe five. And then there was a lot of filler in between and a lot of getting the orders to do stuff and whatever. But that seems to be enough. You know, one chasing cars. I mean, I know James have made a career out of one song, Sit Down, and you can't do that. But that seems to be the other side of the coin, is that these kids are smart and they know how to push their own career and do their own things. And that's what's going to happen. And I think people will find little niches. And Teenage Fan Club have got one. I went to see them at the Royal Northern College of Music about 6 or 7 weeks ago. And it was like an 800 capacity, 900 capacity venue, sold out. And they're doing their own merchandising. And Jared's left the band for quite a while now. So they've got this guy in David playing bass. But they've got this young kid from a band called Gorky's Zygotic Mindset. And he looks like an angel, but his voice, Tony, what a voice, absolutely fantastic. And then they've got this other young lad who played guitar and whatever. And all those years when people were saying, oh, they used to sound like the Beach Boys, and I was thinking, I don't think so. There's only really Norman who can sing that well, you know. Because I tell you what, they're really good now. And they went down an absolute storm. And they tour and they make records and they're earning a living and that's enough for them. That's enough for them. And I think America gives you even more of that sort of space for that. I used to try and explain to bands, you know, because I did a lot of tour managing before I did managing, that just because you've sold out the 930 Club in Washington, it doesn't mean you're going to be a star in America, you know. Mm-hmm. And that is what would happen. The English bands, they'd come through, they'd do all the venues that you and I know, you know, that little, what's the name, hall in Philadelphia and the 930 Club in Washington, I always remember. Mm,
yeah.
And I remember doing America with the Sugar Cubes, and it was the hottest summer for 70 years. with all these Icelandic, it was murder. And the air conditioning was like iffy on the bus, you know, it was on and off.
Great memories.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I tell you what, we had a reporter from People magazine following us around, you know. because they were they were kind of like novelty, weren't they? And America loves new; everything has to be new. Of course, Bjork, as she is now.
Let me tell you that I interviewed her in a hotel in Manchester a long, long time ago, and I asked her the same thing. I said, before we start, is it Bjork or Bjork? And she looked at me, Chaz, and she went, Bjork, as in jerk.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that.
Well, she's given up now, because the last time I saw her, I said, did they just call you Bjork? And she said, yeah, I've given up. I haven't got the energy to fight it any longer, you know.
Ah, so wonderful to reunite with these people after so many years. I was working with Chaz with the Pixies' Doolittle, which I think was late 80s, so a long, long time ago. But it brings back all the memories. Chaz worked as a tour manager, a manager. You're hearing stories of the stuff that he did, and you'll hear more to come. You are listening to Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michaelides, and we'll be back with more of Chaz Banks after this.
So with your tour managing days, Chaz, how did you get into that? Were you very young when you started?
I had a sort of a late career, really, because I had a proper job for a few years and married with a couple of kids. And then I got into it through having mates who were in a band and driving them around in a van, mm-hmm. This old van. And then doing odd bits at Manchester Apollo on the humping crew. That used to be good fun. Had some good fun doing that, and that was like, you do the loading in the morning. It's purely physical work. But having said that, you had a really good crew there, and the guy who ran it, Bill, used to have this book. And if you were in town, you phoned him up if you'd come off tour. So you had like a crew of like lighting guys and sound guys and backlight, and then the lighting guys would help him put the lights in them. People used to love and come and play at the venues, and we ended up doing like bigger venues. So I got into that, and then what would happen is, like, we were doing, I think it was Cool and the Gang, and the driver of the back line truck had to go home because his wife was ill. So the tour manager said to Bill, do you know anyone who's sensible and who can drive a truck? And they said, yeah, we've got such a. So I got into that, and then I ended up getting a phone call from them later on after that to do another tour. And could I do this and could I do that? And you'd get into it, and then you'd know bands, and you kind of like move from what different jobs and do different things, and people see you around, and it was all very, I'll tell you a cracking story though from when we were doing those. We were doing so this must be late 70s, we were doing Barry Manilow, and Barry had done three nights at Manchester Apollo, and I have to tell you, Tony, one of the best live shows I've ever seen in my life. Wow. In the late 70s. Absolutely, and I've seen some live shows. It was absolutely astonishing, the quality of the sound and everything and all that, and all these professional backing singers. It was very Broadway. He had this lighting director called Stig Anderson, and he did this thing that I'd never seen before. He counted the house lights down over a count of five, and as he was doing that, he was raising the lights on the big white screen at the back over the light. So you were gradually transitioned into this.
Oh, very cool.
Oh, it was fantastic, man, if you didn't have the prejudices. Anyway, he ended up doing the NEC. And the NEC was, one of the big, it still is, I suppose, one of the big venues. And we'd been in there since 6 o'clock in the morning, loading all the gear, and then I'd been up in the roof. And I had like overalls on, I was covered in shit, you know. And I was stood by the lighting desk. And my job, because you'd get extra work, like staying on and working in the afternoon, even after all the stuff was in, and the lighting director, Stig, would stand on the stage, in the center of the stage, and he'd call out a number to me and say, like, 104 on the radio, and I'd pull up the fader on 104, and then there'd be two guys up in the Hoyt rig in there, and they would focus it, then he'd move round, and, you know. Anyway, I'm stood there doing this, and who comes walking up the aisle but Barry, as himself.
Really?
Swear to God. In this white, yeah, it must have been white, or as white as you could get it, rabbit jacket. What do they call it? It's not a fur coat, it's a something, I can't remember. Anyway, in this white, with white Cuban heel boots on, and this woman that he used to carry around with him is his beard. that was supposed to be like his girlfriend. This was before he came out, you know, and all that. And he came up to me at the death, and you know how the Americans use sir, it's like the French do the same, you know, he said, excuse me, sir. If I were to sing We'll Meet Again tonight, do you think the audience would know it? And I haven't spoken that time. And I pulled my lighter out of the pocket and lit it. We'll meet again. don't know where.
It's an anthem, for God's sake.
Oh, we'll meet again.
Yeah.
He laughed, to be fair. He laughed, he smiled. Said, thank you very much, and off he went. And 20 minutes later, his tour manager came off and gave me 20 quid.
Really?
Excellent. Yeah, I got a little tip. Yeah, I was only getting 70 quid for the day, so it was a good tip.
Brilliant.
So that was Barry. So then you end up meeting bands and you're doing sound. And so I could do front of house sound, I could do monitors, I could do lights, I did all sorts of stuff. Work with guys like Bruce Mitchell, all the old.
Oh, yeah.
So get known around Manchester, and then it sort of spreads a little bit. And then we decided, really, that the thing that set us off was we decided that the future was going to be splitter bands. Nobody had done this up to now. We used to have separate bands or sit on the amps. So everyone said, oh, don't do this, it'll be a disaster, you know. But anyway, we did it, and we got this big band, this big, huge thing, and put a bulkhead in and equipment for the back. 12 seats inside, and me and Shirley at the front. And then we got in a contact with 4AD. And we did the Pixies and the Throwing Muses. And the Throwing Muses were the headline, the Pixies were in the back. But this was around about the time when girls were starting to be seen in bands.
Yeah, yeah.
In the early 90s. And so what that meant for... And they were coming over to Europe, and the way it used to work then was they'd come in and they'd play like the Mean Fiddler in London, then you'd go off to Europe and do your European tour, and they were all like youth centres in Holland or whatever, or, you know, places, depending on how big you were. And then you'd come back and you'd usually finish it like the Town and Country Club. And what we offered them was a vehicle, £600 a week, me and Joe, £600 a week. Affordable, but decent money. I mean, back in the day it was, and PDs and whatever, and which we used to live off. Cheese and ham all the time. but what the bands got, what the record company got, was they got me doing the technical stuff, making sure the sound was all right and all that.
So but doing the live sound as well?
In some cases, yeah, many
wow.
cases. Did the DBs front of house sound? I'm trying to think who else I did. It's hard to remember, to be honest. I was looking for my diary the other day to try and remember who we did and who we didn't do. The Darling Buds, I did the front of house sound for them. And we went from one tour to, we'd finish one tour on a Thursday and start the next tour on the Friday with the same gear, with the same truck, with the same PA, with the same crew, and just move everything around, you know, and go on. It was a busy time. But what they had was in Sher was someone who used to do the press, British Leyland, and also for BR&B. She worked for BR&B. You'll remember BR&B.
Yeah, I do.
Big station. And for record companies, it was always difficult to get tour managers to focus on getting the press done because they didn't want to do it. You know, they considered it to be a bit of a pain. But Sher didn't, so they got all the press done, got the technical stuff done. And for the bands, we were like in our early, I went as 41, 42, 40, well, late 30s, early 40s when we started this. What they got was like an auntie and an uncle.
Mm.
We were like, cool, you know, because we could do all this stuff. There's a big difference to them, you know, having a woman on the tour.
Oh, yeah.
Coming into this male environment. So we could. So if Kim had if Kim was getting a period and she needed some painkillers or whatever, she could go to Shirley and have a chat with her, which was easier for her than coming to this big 6'3" giant like me, you know, and that whole sort of vibe worked really well with us being a couple. So we moved from that, and then we kind of fell into management with Teenage Fan Club. I mean, with Pixies, really, we were basically doing the European management in the early years.
Who managed them?
A guy called Ken Goes. He's in Massachusetts. He hardly leaves his house. You know, he's scared of flying. He only came over once. Decent bloke, but not really a rock and roller, that's for sure. I think he was some sort of counsellor. But Charles eventually fired him. After he fired him, I think he got an idea about how pissed off he'd been making people, you know.
Mm.
A lot of people did Ken in his day. But there you go. So and with Teenage Fan Club, I went to America with them and we'd do Saturday Night Live.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and it was like the record company was so excited. And we were like, it's only a TV show, you know, why are you so excited? Oh no, it's a big deal. Arrived at the hotel, bottles of champagne, big bunches of flowers and all that. And it was the only time I ever got upset with bloody Brendan. Got this beautiful bottle of vintage champagne. And he only opened the bloody thing and drank it at room temperature, didn't he?
Sounds like John Bonham.
Brendan, you bloody hooligan. But yeah, we did the Saturday Night Live and that went down really well. And it was all rocking along. And then for some reason, Gary Gersh, who was in charge then, took the video off MTV, which at that time was a big deal. And no one's ever really been sure why he did it. He had this sort of cunning plan. But his cunning plan was that he was going to go with this next song. I think he was going to go with one of Jared's songs. But then he buggered off to Capitol.
Mm.
And then it's like, who do you want as your A&R guy, you know? And we all went with nice lad, actually, Mark Cates. He's got his own record label in Boston now. He looks after management. He was there. And they weren't really mad for it. They signed the Stone Roses, you know.
Did they?
That was Gary Gersh.
Oh, of course, yeah, yeah.
And I was over there.
After like years of litigation, they eventually signed to Geffen, didn't they?
Yeah. So I was over there, and with American labels, they expect the manager to work the company, to sort of do their job for them, or they did then anyway. So that was part of your job. So I went over there. I was living in LA for about 3 weeks, staying in a hotel, staying at the Riot House, and they provided me with an office and everything, you know. And I was just walking back from the toilet, and who should I bump into but the Stone Roses being given the dog and pony show, you know, being toured around the building. And he was like, oh, Jazz, how are you? And all, because you've seen this strange face, you know, because I'd driven them down to that studio down in Cornwall on the creek, I can't remember.
The Stone Roses?
Yeah, yeah. And Shirley had driven them down as well, so they knew us, you know. He was cheeky little bit. Tell us what it was like in the 60s, Jazz.
Stone Roses are an amazing story. But yeah, I'd love to hear some stories about, like, you know, life on the road and things that you experienced. Because it's really interesting what you were saying about... you know, girls coming into bands and things, because I mean, it was a rarity. Whereas now, I mean, some of the biggest artists, from Adele to Taylor Swift, I mean, try and think of people as big as them, and they're both females, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can only really look at the heritage acts, can't you? Like the Stones and that, and they'll be gone soon.
But when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about the tribute stuff, because that's really interesting. Because I went to see there's the Brit Floyd and the Australian Pink Floyd, and I went to see them in Clearwater here. And a friend of mine was going, and they had a few tickets left. And I said to my wife, I said, well, why don't we buy the cheapest tickets and sit at the back? Why do you want to watch five blokes who aren't the Pink Floyd? Why don't we sit at the back, watch the lights, watch the audience, the stage show, and close your eyes and hear the music? And they're so good. But the thing is, all those people who weren't as... I mean, I kind of am quite out there with it. I say, well, I was lucky enough to see everybody who ever meant anything to me in under 2,000 seaters. I didn't have to go into football fields to watch bands. I remember going to see Springsteen here when I first emigrated, and I'm watching the screens on the side of the stage. I know who it is because I know the songs and his name's on the ticket, but I might as well be on YouTube.
I saw him three nights running at the Apollo,
I was there.
I think it was after the first number, and it was, or second number, wasn't it?
That was the River Tour, I think, wasn't it?
It was the River Tour, and he jumped off the front of the stage and ran up the aisle and was actually physically grabbing hold of people's hands and putting it together like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I did that Apollo gig for about 3.5-4 years on and off, and saw some amazing stuff, some absolutely amazing stuff. Saw Meatloaf there, saw Talking Heads, saw All for Free, getting paid as well to do it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Hard work, but... And we went through the heavy metal and AC/DC. I was doing a father. What used to happen was you get 75 quid for the loading and the loadout. And if you stayed in the afternoon, you got an extra 30 quid.
And you got to watch the gig, though, as well.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it was a bit of a pain watching the gig because you didn't really want to watch it, you know. Japanese. Some of the Yellow Magic Orchestra from Japan.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there was loads of people who had been out papering the gig, and there was about 40 people in there.
So you know Sarge from the gate, from the backstage door then?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, he was there for forever, wasn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. Probably still is now.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I remember doing AC/DC and I got to do a follow spot. Now, you got 30 quid for a follow spot, and if you did a trust spot, you got 40 quid. I used to climb up the rope ladder, a big lad, climb up the rope ladder and sit on the truss. I remember Stuart...
Copeland.
Stuart Copeland. Add on his Toms, fuck off, you.
Great.
Anyway, I was doing this fella spot on AC/DC, and there was four of us, and this guy came on in an Aussie accent. I won't try and do the accent, but you've got your headphones on, and he says, who's on house right? And I said, that's me. He said, right, you're number one. Your guy is the bass player. So he said, when he walks to the front of the stage, turn it on. When he walks back, turn it off. So I said, what about colours? He said, oh, we don't fuck about with colours. We don't do any of that shit. Number two, your man is whatever. Number two and three, your man is Angus. I'd like to wish you the best of luck.
Excellent.
Do your best to keep following the little shit. Number four, your guys, you know, and that was it, yeah. And they had a dartboard set up, you know, because they had like this set going up at the back. Around the back, they had it all set up like a pub with a dartboard and draft beer. Don't ask me how they did that, Tony.
Well, the thing is, when you think of it, looking back to those days, and we can come back to it and talk about it again, but there was a culture built up on the road, wasn't it? A camaraderie between the artists and the people around them. And that's what I love about... You know, having worked with people like Bowie and stuff. I mean, maybe we can talk about that another time. Because didn't the Pixies support Bowie?
Well, we did. David Bowie came to see us. Me and Sheryl and the band went for dinner with him.
I'd love to leave that till another time, Chaz, because I know we're going to get slung off. But the thing is, I'll throw in the questions then, because I know for a fact, because what I loved about Bowie was the fact that, you know, he wasn't frightened to put people like the Pixies and Nine Inch Nails, who at the time were cooler and more relevant than he was, because he was going through making, you know, different types of records like Tin Machine and stuff like that. But he wasn't worried about almost being blown off the stage. But he would also, correct me if I'm wrong, stand at the side of the stage and watch the support band. How does that make you feel?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he'd do all that. But I also think that
we will come back and revisit this, by the way.
Yeah, I do think that he wanted the attachment. He would like to have been involved with the production. He would like to have got whatever, you know what I mean? He wanted to be seen with the cool people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's one of those things. But let me tell you one last story about touring. So we're on a tour bus with the Pixies, beautiful, and you're sleeping on the bus. We pull into this big garage, which has got a shop. It's somewhere in Germany. We're in.
Ha ha ha! You'll have to wait for that, the story about the Pixies. Who Chaz Banks tour managed. You have been listening to that man, Chaz Banks, with his stories, and we will invite him back because he's got a bunch more stories that he's going to share with us. Thank you for listening. This has been Moments That Rock. I'm your host, Tony Michaelides. We're part of the Pantheon Group of Podcasts, and we will return next week with more. There's plenty others, so scroll back and listen to some more. Thanks.